pass me this one?
I don't blame you.
Call the Resources Committee to order. In attendance, we have Representatives Ledoux, Seaton, Samuels, Ramris, and Gatto. We're joined by Representative Rokeberg. Right now, we'd like to start with a confirmation hearing for the nominee to the Board of Game, Paul Johnson. We should have his resume in front of all of the members right now. And Mr. Johnson, are you online?
Yes, I am.
And if you could maybe, we're joined by Representative Crawford also. Maybe if you could start off by telling us a little about yourself and why you'd want to sit on this. why would you want the second most thankless job in the whole world?
Okay. I'm Paul Johnson. I reside here in Unalakleet, Alaska for a majority of my life. I was born in St. Michael, just south of here, and I come from a large family. My family moved here to Unalakleet in 1964 because the value they placed on higher education. I was able to attend a private high school here in Unalakleet, which was a Covenant High School, and I graduated there as valedictorian of my class. Coming from a large family with 12 siblings, I understand the importance of hunting and gathering wild game and fish. Our families relied on that for years, and we still carry on that tradition in our family of, you know, consuming fish and game. My formal education, I have 4 years of college. I don't have a degree, but I last studied business and finance. I am presently a small boat crab fisherman here in Norton Sound with the Red King Crab Fishery, and have fished for, ever since I was 17 years old, I guess, like most Alaskans. Over the years, I've served on several local civic organizations and am presently a Class A assistant guide for the last couple of years. During the formation of the CDQ groups and Norton Sound Economic Development Corporation, I was president for a few years, or a little over a year, until I was hired by the Unalakleet Native Corporation as the CEO, where I worked for 10, 11 years or so. And during those years, I was instrumental in working with the tribe, the city, and our Native corporation in working to solve community problems and in bettering infrastructure and other social concerns in the community. Being a fisherman, I've also built and welded aluminum boats with my brother for about 8 years or so, participating in the herring, primarily for the herring fishery. And with my work experience and having served on the Southern Norton Sound Advisory Committee, I've done a lot of traveling to various regions of the state and have a fair understanding of the makeup of our state and a fair understanding of how the boards of game and fish work, you know, having gone before them testifying for different issues over the years. I ran and completed the Iditarod in 1986, which was quite a challenge. So I'd like to say that I'm not a stranger to public service locally, and I'm not sure why, but I look forward to serving the state of Alaska on more of a statewide basis, serving on the Board of Game, and hopefully can bring my personal experiences and hopefully some common sense to managing our game resources.
Okay. So, Mr. Johnson, just generally speaking, just some of the big issues that would be facing the Board of Game, or ongoing issues, I should say, is what do you think about predator control just in general? Wolves or bears, either one?
I believe that predator control is necessary when the situation warrants it, depending on what the facts of the situation are in whatever region the problem exists. I'm well aware of the impact of predators on game, primarily moose and caribou, especially in our region.
Okay. What do you think the other, if you picked out three or four other really big items that you think would be facing the board over the next several years, what do you think they would be?
I'm not sure exactly what they would be, to tell you the truth. I'm on a statewide basis, other than for what's been in the news about predator control. Like I said, I just hope to use common sense and to take each issue individually, weighing the facts, the biological facts, and the needs of the whatever region is applied, and to use that information to make a good decision. I don't have any particular issue I can think of right offhand.
Okay. Are there any other questions for Mr. Johnson? We do have some people to testify here. Questions? No? We're going to go, if you stand by with us for just a second there, Mr. Johnson, we're going to go to the Fairbanks LIO, and we have Virgil Umphenor. Is that correct? How badly did I butcher that last name, Virgil?
That's close enough, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Go ahead with your testimony.
My name is Virgil Umphenor. I live in North Pole. And I know Mr. Johnson. I've known him for quite some time. When I was on the Board of Fisheries, he was involved with a number of issues concerning crab fishery in Norton Sound and also the herring fishery. And so I want to speak favorably for his confirmation. And that's about all I have to say.
Okay. Well, thanks for taking the time today to come down and testify on Mr. Johnson's behalf. Is there anybody else online that would like to testify? Anybody else in the audience? No? Okay, and there's no more questions from the committee? With that, we'd take a motion to forward the name of Mr. Paul C. Johnson to the Board of Game.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Resource Committee forward the name of Paul C. Johnson to the full body for approval.
Is there any objection to that? Seeing none, Mr. Johnson's name. Thank you very much for taking the time to testify, Mr. Umphenor. And Mr. Johnson, thank you very much for taking the time for your service to the state of Alaska. We will well know how thankless the job probably is going to be. So, thank you.
Okay, you're welcome, and thank you.
Okay, moving on. We're still on the heavy oil bill, and what we wanted to do today, we do have folks online. I believe we've got Dan Seamount with AOGCC available to answer questions. Bill Van Dyke with Oil and Gas. Frank Paskvan with BP. Robert Mintz with the AG's office. And Mr. Spencer, who was with us yesterday from ConocoPhillips. They're all online and available to answer questions. But what I'd like to do is go through. We'd identified several of the big ticket items, generally speaking, and without getting into the actual language of the L version that we are on right now, if I can get the sense of the committee of where the committee wants to go, then I can work with the sponsor of the bill and with Mr. Mintz and with Robin to try to craft a CS to be adopted perhaps the early part of next week. And try to just incorporate some of the general thoughts in what we want to do. So with that, the list that I had here, and I can start at the top, or anybody can jump in with general ideas that you want, or we can just open up the general topics you want, or I can go down my list, and if I miss something, then jump in. Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. On page 5 of the L version, is that the version in front of us?
We have the L version in front of us. Yes, sir.
I look down the list on line 20 down, 1, 2, 3 through 9, and 9 seems to cover everything else, but I don't see nuclear in here.
I think there will be a motion to delete that entire section. So if we want to go into the details of that, we can, but I think generally speaking, the hallway conversations that I've had, there's not going to be a lot of willpower to offer credits only to oil companies to do these types of projects when we're not going to offer them to Siri at Fire Island, is the one that comes to mind, or any other company that would be an alternate energy company. So Let me go through my list, and then I said we'll get through there. The first issue is credits for research and development. And the testimony came, I believe, we put it to the Conoco engineer that was here yesterday, and I personally have trouble with it. How are you going to audit R&D that's done, even if it's done in the state? I see a problem with tracking that, and it may or may not lead to the development of heavy oil, which is the entire point of the legislation. So I don't know what everybody thinks about research, the credit for research, or Representative Gatto.
I can just make a comment. If you're referring to page 2, line 25, where it uses research or development.
Correct.
And I was really nervous about the word or. If you intend to strike the whole thing, that's one issue. But if you put or in, then research can be wide open if it doesn't lead to development.
That is my thought exactly. I'm just eliminating a credit on any R&D work that the industry may do. And Representative Crawford and then Roper.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with you. And when we're talking about R&D, we're talking really about research and development of techniques, not the development of the field. Just for that clarification, and I agree that it gets into whole bailiwick and that those techniques can be developed anywhere in the world or used anywhere in the world, and it becomes very problematic. And
auditing is difficult. You don't know what you're going to get. So, Representative Crawford.
Ditto.
Representative Roper. And comment on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then that begs the question about how broad. If you don't want to narrow it to those types of things, then I take it the sense is to broaden it in its application. That's the logical extension of the comment. I appreciate the problems in terms of narrowing it to try to identify what those elements are. But that's, I presume then the preference of the committee would be otherwise, to have a general, some type of general applicability to heavy oil activity.
My thought would be if we're going to move forward with the idea is to move forward with offering the development. And we're going to get to geography. It says at WESTSAC, right, the expenses you had at WESTSAC,
right,
we're going to give you the credit on. Because I know it's all heavy oil. Okay. DNR has agreed WESTSAC at a certain depth.
Right. Okay.
The research that you may or might, even research you might do in Anchorage, and certainly research you're going to do in Bartlesville or wherever BP might be, that it's going to be tough for the state to go in there and go, how is that directly linked to Alaska? And
well, then that, if that being the case, that clarifies a good deal, and that's a major decision, and I have no problem with that at all, really. It's just because it gives us direction. And then that sets a foundation for working the rest of the bill,
yeah,
and if that be the case. And I would assume then, and Mr. Chairman, with your knowledge of 488 and any iterations are being worked on, that we could really just duplicate the provisions for implementation and auditing of those credits in totally consistent with 488. Would that be correct?
I would assume that language would be identical. It would just be another credit for a specific area at a specific depth.
Right, so it would be an add-on.
And then
you want to talk about that now, or do you want to go on your other list?
Let me go down my list.
Okay, let's do it.
R&D, there's no other discussion about that. I've got the next on my list was the rate of the credit depending on the PPT. The Senate came out with a 25% credit, and it's who knows how it all ends. It could be 20, it could be 25, it could be 30. Who knows what the tax rate will be? So that's something that, to tell you the truth, we can work with Ms. Bilson and draft the bill and then discuss that early next week. Some other things might come clear on what the rate would be. Maybe we want a rate in the aggregate, can't exceed X, or we can work that out without having a major discussion right now. I don't see how we're going to reach any consensus if we don't know what's going to happen with 305 or 488. Representative Roper.
My thinking on that, I think that clearly if there's, it's got to be related to what the baseline is in the primary bill. So, for example, if you had a 25% credit in the primary bill, I think it would be appropriate to make a reduction in this credit, all things being equal. Just to put that.
Representative Wilson, Ms. Wilson, sure, come on up.
Honorary.
You spent more time in this room than any of us have, so.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Robin Wilson, I'm Director of Tax Division. I was thinking about that very question last night about, your concern about perhaps a shifting credit rate in the PPT bill as it goes through committee discussions. I was thinking, and I'm not a drafting attorney, but it seemed to me that if the pleasure of this committee is that given a PPT credit rate of 20, that this credit rate would be 15, then it seems to me the committee is envisioning a total credit there of 35. And so it seems to me it could be drafted so that this credit rate is equal to 35% less the credit rate in the such and such a section. Seems like that would end up to be, whether that moves up or down a little bit.
Okay.
Seems like that could work.
Don't go anywhere, because we've got some very specific questions for you come out of our. From Crawford and Seaton are going to have a specific question for me when I get to that point of my list.
Oh.
Okay, the credit rate, we can deal with that on the draft. How we determined what heavy oil is, and there was discussion yesterday for those people that kind of came and went out of the meeting yesterday. It seemed to reach a consensus of naming the specific area, West Sac or Ugnew or wherever these formations might be. DNR has said that yes, you don't find a whole lot of light oil, and then you get into heavy oil. It's usually an area that's all heavy oil. The engineers that testified from the companies, pretty much everybody was singing the same song on that one. So I think the consensus that I heard yesterday was we just name these areas, the current areas that are heavy oil areas, and the debate was on when we want to add a new area. So as time goes on and 10 years goes by or something, or 2 years goes by, you want to add a new area. DNR has said that, yes, this is a heavy oil field, and the legislature said we want to apply this credit. Do they have to come to the legislature to get that area added, or can the commissioner do it in the administration? Everybody in this room, in the audience, and at the table knows the difficulty of getting a piece of legislation through this body. Or through the entire process, no matter how simple it may seem at the time. On the other hand, do you really want to give a 15% credit to one individual to the tune of, at least tens of millions of dollars, if not over the long term, hundreds of millions of dollars of credits because they added one area? And that was the debate that we had yesterday. And I guess I've just opened it up to the committee that there's pros and cons both ways. So.
Just for openers, Mr. Chairman, I know Mr. Van Dyke's on board. There is he issued a memorandum. I just want to make sure that the committee members had received it. I'm not sure if it has been distributed.
I had it in my email.
Right. It was to Samuel Seaton Rokebrig. I don't know if anybody else has received it. So it might be appropriate to have it distributed.
Tim? Sorry. Sorry.
Mr. Van Dyke has his opinion. I think it's appropriate that it be compared to the other definition that we want to consider and get his opinion on for the committee's consideration.
As far as the question on, we can work with DNR and get the current areas and find a definition to have those areas put into the legislation. But as far as moving forward, I said that you can argue either side with a lot of logic. So, Representative Seaton.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, I would just say that, we talked about having this a 10-year window because it takes a long time for development, a long time for estimating, and a long time for putting into the system. So I don't see this as a crucial decision that needs to be made by the commissioner at a certain point. What we have is if we have a discovery of other areas that we haven't identified here, the testimony by industry is it's a long lead time. And so they have time to come approach us, and I just, like I say, the testimony here was that one of the developments was going to be $2 billion, which is $300 million in credits, and if the commissioner makes his finding, it's $300 million to a company, and I think that is the size of determinations that ought to be coming back to the legislature. So that's just, I stated that before.
What would revenue, I mean, I'm assuming the administration would say the commissioner's fine, but I'm going to ask you anyway. But what would be revenue's perspective on that, knowing the choice to make?
Mr. Chairman, I think revenue's perspective would be, given enough guidelines and criteria, that the comfort level goes up. I just get very nervous when it says the commissioner shall determine or the commissioner shall certify or whatever, and not be given the criteria upon which to make such a judgment. I think, you know, whether and I'm not sure that should be Department of Revenue that makes it the call on the formation. That may be more appropriately done by DNR.
Okay, and I'm going to ask Mr. Van Dyke the exact same question. Mr. Van Dyke, your comments on the choice that the policy choice that the committee will try to make here on should you allow the commissioner to make that, and if we followed Ms. Wilson's suggestion that we put the criteria for making this decision, the API gravity or however you want to do it, and some of that is outlined, I realize, in your definitions and guidelines email, but what would you, just generally speaking, do you think it should have to come back through the legislative process or into the commissioner's office?
Mr. Chairman, Bill Van Dyke with the Division of Oil and Gas. I'm certainly comfortable leaving that decision with the administration. You know, it could be that, you know, the administration, you know, whichever commissioner makes this decision would, you know, report the decision to legislative budget and audit, or which we do that for royalty modifications right now, or certainly, you know, the decision would have to be certainly posted and be a public decision. But I'm comfortable with that decision in the administration. If you think about a 15% credit on a $500 million project, which I think if you just focus on Viscous Oil, that's a pretty big project. You know, you're talking that's not a couple hundred million dollars right there. The project in Prudhoe would obviously be a little bit bigger, but that's probably the biggest Viscous Oil project that we're going to see on the North Slope, at least in one bite. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Crawford and then Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I notice here in this proposed definitions and guidelines, you went to an API gravity of 22. In the bill, it's, I think, 25. Could you give me a little clarification as why you would use either number? What would be the pros and cons of either of the numbers? And also, I was talking to some folks earlier this morning, and they were talking about in other instances of challenged oil that we also have a ability to apply for royalty relief. Would this bill be in addition to royalty relief as well? Because apparently we have granted royalty relief in challenged oil situations in the past.
Through the chair, Representative Crawford, I think it was, we've discussed previously that, I mean, there is no single bright definition for challenged oil or viscous oil. I think the USGS uses 22 degrees API as a, you know, in their publications as a standard for heavy oil or viscous oil. Actually, there's a, you know, there's a glossary of terms related to the PPT that has a definition for heavy oil in there also. I'm not sure it's actually used in the current PPT legislation anywhere else other than in a glossary, but in there it's 20 degrees API. So, you know, we've looked at other references for viscous oil. I just felt comfortable, and the staff here certainly felt more comfortable at the 22 degree number relative to 25. And then with respect to your question on royalty modifications, certainly, I mean, if these credits were enacted, royalty modification could be granted on top of these credits, but certainly when we did the economic analysis, we would take into consideration that the project was earning tax credits in the economic evaluation.
Thank you.
Mr. Van Dyke, it was my impression that the only royalty relief that the Strait has granted was the Pioneer royalty relief at Ugarich, and that was very recently. And it might have been, I don't think it was heavy oil by definition. It had its own set of difficulties, obviously, but it's a relatively new program that hasn't been used. I don't know if DNR has turned down the applications or if the industry has just found that it just didn't work for them on their economics to go through that system. But it's my impression we've only granted it once, and that was very recently.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, you're correct. Under the traditional royalty modification, the Pioneer application is the only one we've granted. We've had numerous discussions with other lessees. We've just never gotten to the end of the process with them. And there certainly are some, the mechanical royalty modifications for Cook Inlet, you know, they're just based on production rates per platform. Those are operating today and actually reduce royalty for some of the platforms. But the Pioneer request was granted, and you're correct, it was not because of viscous oil. It was, a similar challenge, just low flow rate wells.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Roekberg.
Mr. Chairman, on that point, as my 1995 as the chairman of the Oil and Gas Committee and had the privilege of working on the famous bill, House Bill 207, which was a rewrite of 180J provisions of our statute, which had it within it the ability for the commissioner to grant royalty relief on marginal oil fields. We rewrote the only history before where there was provisions in statute to allow for that. There was one time when Mr. Harold Hines was the commissioner of DNR, received an application from Conoco Company before they had their various mergers, when they were the owner of Milne Point. They asked for relief for their then the finding of heavy oils for royalty relief, and it was turned down. Then the House Bill 207 rewrite happened in 1995. As a result, in my considered opinion, our colleagues across the building made the statute unworkable, to say nothing of almost unintelligible. And there was one application by Unocal in the Cook Inlet under that was not granted, because that was nothing to do with heavy oil. It had to do with defining different horizons. So you're right, Mr. Chairman. The only grant of royalty relief under the 180J provisions of our oil and gas regulations has been the Ugru area, which was not directly related to heavy oil per se. It had to do with their formations, I recall. Right? So that's, and there's a misconception, I think, in the public and even in our legislature that the legislature has granted a series of relief. The only other real relief has been statutory relief. As Mr. Van Dyke just pointed out, there were some bills that called in the Cook Inlet that lowered the royalty by statute, and the legislature did that, to try to develop some. And then there's been the expiration credits and other things like that that have come into play over the years. But that's a common misconception that the legislature has changed the law. One other thing, the North Star rewrite of that lease, which there was a request from the company to rewrite that net profits lease to be able to get that
done. Set of problems.
Right. But that's, frankly, that's I think, an important historic understanding of this committee and the legislature needs to understand that. There hasn't been, albeit we've been trying to get development, there hasn't been that area. And one thing I'd caution the committee about, that area is where you have the discretion of the commissioner involved, and it becomes problematic, as we found under the 185 credits that are not always granted upon application. So we need to be aware of that. And Mr. Chairman, my position is I'm trying to look through the bill here and find the where the grant is made by the commissioner. I think that commissioner should be the commissioner of Department of Natural Resources and not the commissioner of Revenue. I'm not sure how it's drafted now, but I think it should be the Commissioner of Natural Resources making that
recommendation.
They're more competent in terms of their geological understanding of the situation.
So what I'd just like more input, if we have the definitions in here saying he can, you know, give it the discretion of the commissioner, but the API gravity has to be, and we can figure out a number. I'm going to ask the engineers from the companies how they determine, you know, if DNR says 22 or the national organization says 22. If we put the parameters in there and then leave it at the discretion of the commissioner, or we can still make them come back to the legislative process. I know what Representative Seaton thinks. I know what Representative Roekberg thinks.
I just wanted to make a couple of questions. Look at this page 202, and that middle paragraph is that we can, the commissioner will be able to do these, or he'll be able to do them for other areas, possibly even regular oil that's
Where are you?
Using on page 2 of the
Van Dyke comments.
The Van Dyke comments says the commissioner may grant the credits for challenge oil produced from the areas excluded from eligibility under the definitions above for challenge oil if that oil is produced using enhanced oil techniques other than the approved non-conventional recut. So, I mean, the applicability of this can be for damn near anything the commissioner approves. I mean, it didn't even...
It would be what we put in the bill.
If this kind of a definition, and we just haven't had any trouble getting credits through. I mean, we've done cooculant credits, since I've been here, we did credits for 185, we've extended 185, we did the exploratory credits. I mean, it's not as if there have been credit bills that come through and haven't been passed. So it's not as if the if it's appropriate, it's not as if the legislature doesn't look at them.
Any other feedback if you wanted to add a new area?
Oh, Mr. Chairman.
Is anybody who I don't know what they think but hasn't addressed?
Well, this is going on to the geographic area there. Different tack. Mr. Van Dyke made his recommendations, which are similar in their identification of areas and units to what we received from the producers yesterday. But there is a major distinction, and I'd like Mr. Van Dyke to speak to those. I'm looking on his page of Mr. Van Dyke's memorandum of the 21st. And Billy, on your item 2, where you talk about West Sac formation, you wish to exclude drill sites 1C, 1D, E, and J, as well as under the Milne Point Schrader Bluff of drill site S. Could you explain to the committee why you would want to exclude those?
Representative Ruckberger, through the chair, I guess the intent there in my definition number one would be to exclude areas that are where projects are well underway and projects are going to occur in the next year or two, I believe, with or without these credits in place. It would be there are some sweet spots in the reservoir, some core areas in the viscous oil reservoirs that are under producing today, and I think will be developed even more in the next few years to come. I think being a frugal type of person, there's probably not necessary to grant credits in those areas, in those formations, but it certainly is necessary to consider credits, outside the core areas. And certainly in formations like the Agnew, where there's no regular production today, and the oil is very viscous. So it would be definition number one is an attempt to kind of just carve out the sweet spots that are under development today. But then under the guidelines, you'll see that even if it came back to these sweet spots and core areas for enhanced oil recovery, I think it would make sense to grant credits for enhanced oil recovery in the sweet spots, but then credits for development outside of the sweet spots in the reservoirs.
Okay, and we can work with the department as we draft the bill. But if there's no more input on the process, then I'll come up with something, and we'll see how everybody likes it.
I just had one other question. That was when we were doing PPT, mm-hmm. and we had some other credit determinations that we talked to the commissioner about, and the commissioner said, you'd really want to throw that on the commissioner to make a $100 million decision.
On the buybacks.
And I think that has been the feedback from the commissioner, that those kind of considerations should be made by the legislative body. So
that was Representative
Corbis. Follow up on that point.
Yes.
I think, Representative Steen, I think you should be look at more comfortably if we can decide by the definition that these particular areas here should be called out, and those in part there's a general recognition that they would have qualified. It's just the one, if the only discretion comes about if there's new
new areas could apply to be, have that consideration. So if we have sufficient guidelines in here, then he should be able to do it rather than come back to the legislature. Because I think that speaks to the investment decision-making and the time frame to be able to make that investment could be affected by a bureaucratic or process of coming to the legislature, which is, I don't think, necessary if we have sufficient definition and sideboards in the procedure.
Ms. Wilson?
Just one thought to put on your list.
We've gotten to number two.
Well, this is a subcategory of discretion and so on. But just if the committee chooses to go down the path that there is a discretion in certifying a particular area is heavy oil, then it would be important to spell out the process of approval. And I'm thinking in terms of timing. Would an area have to be certified first before creditable expenses are incurred, or just what? So that's sort of a sub-part of the present topic.
Do you see it being a problem still, is that you won't know whether it's heavy oil until you drill that first exploratory well in a new area? And the testimony from the engineers said you kind of know what you're going to get into, but you're not always 100% accurate, and you won't know until you drill that first well. So you don't know on the math of that first well until you get down there whether you get the credit or not.
Mr. Chairman, that's
a little bit of a chicken and egg.
That's true. And I may be in a little over my technical head here, but I do see that on page two, the credit is envisioned to give for exploration. So an exploratory well, I mean, I guess I would ask Mr. Van Dyke to sort of address timing, but once a once an area is identified as a potential target, then I guess the question of timing should be spelled out.
What I can do also is I'd like to follow up on what Representative Seaton said. I will talk to your boss. I will talk to Commissioner Corbis, because he was the one when we talked at the PPT about the buying back of the credits by the state, leaving it at the discretion of the commissioner, and he's the one that came in and said you really don't want to do that, to put that into one person's bailiwick, define that you were going to do it for this amount and leave it at that. He said do not leave it at the discretion of the commissioner. So I'll touch base with the commissioner of revenue to make sure that, to see kind of where if he would have the same concerns on this. And then as far as which areas and how we define the current areas, I can work with anybody who's interested over the weekend and the first couple days of next week, talk to the companies and see if, you know, this might all be a little moot point. Maybe if we just include WESAC and UGNU, that everybody can, we're arguing for the sake of arguing here. So with that, I'll touch base with Commissioner Corbis, and then I'll work with anybody who's interested on the process and the definitions for the current ones going forward, and then we'll just, once we get the language, we can debate the language. If that's okay with the committee, we can move on. Commissioner with legislature, I'm gonna the rate floating with the price, I know, was a concern that Representative Crawford had. Let's come back to that one. Research and development, if it's been eliminated, that one's gone. Transferable or not. Thoughts, transferable, sellable? Representative Rufford?
I think we kind of had a consensus of not making them transferable yesterday.
I remember yesterday also.
This restricts it. And then I think Ms. Wilson had there was an issue on affiliates. We took that out because that was conflicting with regulation.
Okay. Representative Seaton?
And Mr. Chairman, I think that if we take out on page 2, lines 20 to 24, which we were talking about, that's what Robin was just... taking R&D, but there's other talk that had exploratory. If we were doing exploratory, then we need to have them transferable. If we're taking out the exploratory aspect, then we're talking about development and people paying... I mean, we don't need to have them
through WESAC as well.
Yeah, we don't have to worry about the transferability. But if we are leaving exploratory stuff in, we don't want to cut out all the small guys that don't have big production going and saying this is only for the big guys.
No, I don't, Mr. Chairman, I don't agree with that. The assumption here is the majority of it would be the larger producers. However, we don't want to exclude the smaller producer if they want to take it on. The issue is whether that smaller producer or explorer, an E&P outfit, has some cash flow in Alaska they can offset. So if we just make it a standard on that issue that they have to have before they can take a credit, I think that's okay. You're suggesting we should liberalize it and make it transferable.
No, I'm not. I'm saying, but we need to, I mean, if we're going to have this exploratory part in here, that's where it would need to tie to transferable, because explorers are not necessarily the big guys.
I know, but I don't understand your logic. We just remove transferability for heavy oil credits. That is a base policy call, and then still allow it. That way you don't want to discourage exploration for oil.
I think you're talking two separate issues. Yeah. Not transferable, I think, was the consensus we had yesterday. And as far as the exploration, do you want to have another 15% exploration credit? Because this doesn't say heavy oil on that liner, so we were just going to eliminate.
We're going to eliminate that.
Eliminate that, because you're talking about the development of heavy oil.
Okay.
The exploration, you wouldn't know if you're exploring for heavy oil or not.
Well,
and if you do say it, how would you, I guess a question for either Ms. Wilson or Mr. Van Dyke, how would you determine an exploration expense is looking for heavy oil when you are by definition exploring? We've already got the 185 credits for the true wildcatter. We're up to probably 60% in PPT. So
the practical matter, Mr. Chairman, is that we already know, for example, when you talk to those guys at Chevron, they've taken on a position south of Kuparik, which is a heavy oil prospect, and they're going to drill for heavy oil. So, but it's not included in this list of names here, I don't think, that both the companies and DNR have come up with. Because it's a prospect at this point. So why should we discourage additional heavy oil exploration?
I don't still see. Maybe you can answer the question, Ms. Wilson, on how would you differentiate between all exploration? So you're just adding another 15% exploration tax credit on here, and exploring for heavy oil. How would
we could make a delayed effect? Though they'd have to prove up. They'd have to meet the standards of the guideline. That's because that would be outside the area of named area. You'd have to come in and say, okay, we went into a new area, we discovered heavy oil, and here's what we got. Here's our 25 API or whatever that happens to be, and this is our production flow, and this is how it's done, and we want to get the additional credit retrospective to our actual incurrence of cost. I mean, retrospective application, I think, is not uncommon.
Mr. Chairman, in answer to your question, and Representative Roegberg, it seems to me that to say we'll give a credit for exploration sort of for heavy oil sort of assumes or presupposes that their purpose is heavy oil, which doesn't make real sense to me. And again, you know, my experience in the oil field is shallow. So. But just from a sort of logic standpoint, that doesn't make sense. I guess I would sort of prefer to see either all exploration or none, rather than trying to prove intent to for a company, let's say they would rather go after light crude. They end up finding heavy crude, and then they come back and say, well, we were really sort of looking for heavy crude. That it just I have trouble with the intention and the primary purpose.
Mr. Hurley, would you rather me ask Mr. Spencer these questions? I'm just wondering from a company's perspective, when you go on an exploration, a fishing expedition, so to speak, which I'm doing right now. And if you're not comfortable, that's fine. I can ask Mr. Spencer. But just generally speaking, if you've been following the conversation, how would Conoco, who is considered probably by most people in this room that you do spend money exploring, how would you, do you go exploring for heavy oil? Do you have some seismic that you kind of know what you're after, or how does that work for your company?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, this is Michael Hurley with ConocoPhillips. A lot of times when you're going out looking, you're actually looking for whatever oil you can find, and you haven't drilled a well yet. You're going into an area, all you've got is seismic data. and other G&G that's going to tell you that you have hydrocarbons that you think are going to be in this particular area. You won't know till you drill. Now, you may be looking at areas, for example, that you know are relatively shallow, close to the permafrost. And if you've got a target where you're close to the permafrost, you can expect that it's going to be relatively viscous. But you won't know till you drill. You never know till you drill, unless you're going into a developed or a known area, for example, like the Agnew or the West Sac or the Schrader Bluff kinds of formations. You aren't going to know for sure until you drill.
Okay, so under our scenario then, if we had a new area, Conoco went exploring, you found something you thought would be heavy oil, you drilled, you found it, you would come before the legislature or for the commissioner with a set of parameters on there, you would apply to have area X included in the heavy oil tax credit. How much of the total cost of the exploration have you already expended getting to that point? Not counting your own salary lobbying us to include area X.
Mr. Chairman, it's going to be relatively small. I mean, when you talk about developing a heavy oil resource, you're talking about spending a lot of money in development wells, very expensive development trilateral wells. When you're talking about the very first well, I mean, exploration wells on the slope, depending how close you are to infrastructure, are $10 to $30 million. Kind of range. When you're talking the development of that heavy oil and all the additional development wells you have to drill, all of the facilities you have to put in place to be able to produce heavy oil, that's where the big dollars are.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, I thought we heard from Mr. Spencer yesterday or Mr. Taxman that they had a relatively good idea if they're going to go after a heavy oil prospect above 5,500 feet, that's what they were going after. That was my take on it.
And through the chair, Representative Roquebrook, I agree. When you're drilling for those shallower targets, you have a good idea that it's probably going to be viscous, just because of the nature of the crude and the how close you are to the permafrost. In fact, it's going to be a lot colder.
Yeah, but if light oil and you have the guidelines in there, then they don't get the credit. Or they don't get it for upfront exploration, but if they hit a heavy oil, then that's the criteria. They could go back and supply and say we deserve this credit because we explored for heavy oil. And then I guess the question is, well, we can't produce it because it's only 8 API, so they get the credit. I mean, that's kind of the question there.
But if I follow on to what Mr. Hurley's comments were, it's a small percentage of the money has been expended to get there, and the large amount of the money that you want the credit for, it, once you've found it, then you get then you've approached DNR, the legislature, however we work that out. Then you've come in and says, now we're going to go in and spend a whole bunch of money developing it because we now know it's in the ground. So they get whatever the normal credits under PPT or 185 or whatever works out. They get the normal credits for exploration. They're depending on how far they are from things. But that's the small part of the expenditure on the development. You would then kick into these because then now you know it's heavy oil. DNR has blessed it or the legislature, however you work it out, and you go forward with your development expenditures on that part rather than having just another, because this would become just another exploration tax credit then in addition to the heavy oil development. So I guess the policy call is, do we want to do that or do you want to stick to just the development? And,
I think Representative Seaton has a good point. If we had trouble identifying it, or it was just a rank play that they were going to drill to 9 or 12,000 feet and happen to run into some lenses of heavy oil, then decide they're going to go backwards and try to produce that. That would be a kind of more common kind of occurrence, I would think. On the one hand, or the other hand, we're going to go in there like Chevron said, and we're going to go in there and try to explore for find and produce the heavy oil out from the get-go, and then they got to build a really long road to get there. They don't have the infrastructure.
But it's still the development's the high dollar expenditure.
Well, if that's the case, it just seems to me that road might be expensive. And let's use that new Arctic Fox drilling rig or some other things like that, they can get in there easier.
Okay. Any comments on the exploration?
Well, my problem is that if somebody goes out exploring for gas and can find a little heavy oil, then they can write off, get another 15% off, because guess what? We had exploration, and hey, we ran in some heavy oil, so now we can come to revenue, and revenue is going to be sitting there. Well, there is heavy oil. It's API. This. Oh, now we got to give 15% extra tax credit based on gas exploration. So, you know.
No, I don't disagree with you there. I think that is.
I think if most of the money, I mean, and if it's most of the money is in the development, then I don't mind having the credit for that. I mean, that's fine. But I hate to be going back and forth, depending on what you find in a well. We've already got exploration tax credits on the books. And if we want to incentivize that differently, that's probably a completely separate policy.
Mr. Chairman, let me just carry the argument to another step then. Well, if we identify, let's say, West Sac, or what we use the geographic definitions and the units and so forth, that are the boundaries are clear by the AOGCC and DNR, where there's recognition. Would if you were exploring the shallower depths there, you say you don't get the credit for that? Like you say you get it, you have to discover it first, or can't you discover it? That's kind of the question.
I would view this as once the area has been determined as heavy oil, now you have mostly it's going to be considered development, not exploration.
Okay, that's the key point that should be clear. So
Mr. Van Dyke?
Yes, Mr. Chairman?
Are you following us here? We're kind of going down some trails, but...
Yeah, well, for the most part, yes.
Okay. Any comments so far on Representative Roekberg's question on within West Sac, an expenditure went in there for... a single well, and I don't know how it works. They have an exploration within this field, which DNR has designated as heavy oil. Is everything that's done in that field now, would you consider everything done in that field after it's been designated heavy oil as development? Or would you consider some of that exploration? Once it's all heavy oil, then I would think they get the credit, because that's what's there. You've determined that that's what's there.
Mr. Chairman, I would agree that once, I mean, if you go to a definition, for instance, the West Sac formation within the Kaparik River unit, then any West Sac activity in there would count, as would be creditable.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. I think we beat that one to death. alternate energy. Discussion. Thank you, Mr. Hurley. Alternate energy. Last section. Any comments? I still have problems with giving it to Conoco and BP and Exxon and Anadarko, but not giving it to other people that might want it. But I don't know. I can't imagine. Maybe start a couple windmill farms. Maybe.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I think this is a complicated enough deal just doing the heavy oil, and hopefully it's going to be simpler with PPT. And integrated there, but I think we ought to just excise this portion.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Crawford.
I commend the sponsor for giving it a try.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think it's worth hanging on to. And the rationale being that there was a tax, there was a source of funds that we're creating here. And I guess to follow some projects by energy companies that I think might have some merit. On the other hand, I am very sensitive to the piling on or pig piling for credits that I can get into.
Okie dokie. Last but not least, we're going to go back to Representative Crawford's concern that we spoke about a couple of times. It's more of just a general question, and we can start with either the sponsor of the bill, Tax Division, or DNR, or company representatives, whoever wants to speak up on it. Let's start with, I guess, Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Been talking to a number of people over the last couple of days about this heavy oil credit, and they say that there is a reason to do a heavy oil credit, but it's in a fairly... I mean, well, I guess it's not what you'd call a narrow band, but there's, say it's $30 at the bottom, there's a point there somewhere where they're not going to develop heavy oil no matter what credits we happen to give them. And there's another point at I've had various suggestions at $50 or $55 a barrel where it all becomes economic. What we're influencing is that band in between there where field might be marginal and we might actually get more oil drilled, and that I believe that that's what the sponsor's intent here is, to get more oil developed and into the pipeline. And I don't see a real reason to try to put more advantages on after a certain price, whatever we decide, whether that's $50 or $55 a barrel. Because as one analyst told me this morning, he said, at somewhere around $55 a barrel, all the sins are cured. So that's my thought here.
Representative Seaton.
Yeah, I've been trying to think about this too, and price prospectivity is really hard to gauge. But what we're doing is looking at somewhat on history. And so if we would look at possibly a three-year past average of if it's above $50 a barrel, then the credit wouldn't apply. Meaning if we're into a range where for 3 years we're having $50 barrel oil, average price, they're making their decisions based on what the market is really doing. And at that point in time, we're not needing to pay this. Heavy oil is profitable. And, I don't know if there's any other ideas, but that's one of
them. Mr. Chairman, it's always interesting to use collars and floors and ceilings. We call them a collar in the real estate business and the financing world. But the... I'm concerned here about doing that. Representative Seaton talks about looking at history to give us some predictors. The trouble is, did anybody check it today? I think we hit another all-time record. We're in an area here where we're not familiar with where we're going and where we've been recently. It's way above the norm. So I've been here 12 years, and I got to tell you, whenever it was above $30, that was usually a smiling on her face. But nevertheless, I can. One of my, I guess, criticisms of having any kind of a cap, I don't think there's a need for a floor. The floor is self-fulfilling. As if the price goes down to a point, you're not going to make the investments, you won't make the investments. And that's the business decision. We don't need to artificially say that unless we wanted to.
I wasn't Frank. Talking about a four.
No, we're not talking about
okay,
that.
Okay, just to make sure. You said a band. You know, you're saying below 30.
That's what we're influencing.
Okay. But that, at any rate, regarding a cap, this does have a 10-year sunset. That in itself is done intentionally. We've done that and used that as a device here before. Like on the 185 credits, they've had a sunset. We keep rolling that sunset because... frankly, I think we've done it because they haven't been very effective. Those credits haven't worked quite right. And we've been using that as a goose to try to see if it works. And but I'm not really sold on those entirely. But I think that having a sunset on this particular provision will reach the intention, I think, that should be the policy here, is to incent that development now, kick it up, and the cycle of the fields are such, particularly in heavy oil, that a 10-year cycle here is really quite understandable. And you can talk to the producers just to get the ideas of, like we had the testimony about, I think I asked a question yesterday about how long was it either Orion or Polaris. They've been working pretty hard on some of those on one of the fields from the late 90s and started another one in about 8.03. And they're just starting. I don't think they've even got much of. They've got very little production on any of them yet. But those are the long investment cycles you have to go through. So And I'm very sensitive to having a sunset on this because I think it's necessary, particularly if it's integrated into PPT for a long-range application. That gives the legislature the right to come back and make an adjustment. But I guess I'm throwing a dart at a cap ceiling on it right now. I think, I don't know, we'd have to really look at that. And I would recommend against it at this juncture without hearing any more evidence, and I think it would be hard, we'd be hard for us to find the evidence because we're in a new area.
Ms. Wilson, anything that we do currently or a way to address Representative Crawford and Seaton's concern that at 70 and next week it could be 80 and maybe it sticks around here for a year or two? Why would we incent something even heavy oil at $80 a barrel is knee-deep in money, but realizing that maybe at 45, when still profits are to be made, heavy oil is not being developed. So how do you, can you through tax mechanisms kind of fix our problem of realizing that they're looking at a long-term price picture, which may or may not be true? They need to know what their economics are. I understand that, but it seems to be we're kind of at $70 a barrel, we're throwing a little money down the way. So what, in any way, the tax mechanisms you can see to fix that without having somebody unsure of what their economics are as an investor?
Mr. Chairman, I think what bothers me sort of overall about the idea of having it on price is again back to the timing thing. You know, anytime there's an oil price trigger in the statute, then it's difficult to sort of apply that. For example, if we say it's a three-year average, is that a sort of a moving 3 year? So if I want to expend some money in July, am I looking, you know, the last three Julys, and then what about the costs in August? Maybe those are not creditable, and so you sort of have the potential of it, you know, bumping up and down over the trigger, which is, I think, a little problematic. You know, if you look calendar year, then it's a little bit easier, but again, then sort of this cost in December will qualify. Now this cost in January all of a sudden doesn't. I guess just from a tax administration standpoint, having a sunset in a reasonable amount of time makes some sense. And the other thing I would observe is that, you know, if we'd been having the same discussion 6 years ago, I don't think any of us could have imagined oil at this price. And so the trigger would have been much different, or the shutoff, whatever, however you want to view it. So it's a little difficult sort of to look into the future and say, you know, what the appropriate cutoff might be. So I think I would support the idea of a sunset before a price cutoff.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
This is Jeff Spencer with ConocoPhillips. May I speak?
Yes, you certainly may, Mr. Spencer.
One of the things that you need to keep in mind is that these projects need to be competitive with other investment opportunities that are within each of our company's portfolios. And so at a given price of that $50 a barrel, a light oil project is going to be more attractive to pursue because the lower cost to operate, the higher recoveries and rates that you're going to get, and the better price for your product. And so I guess I would concur with Representative Roekberg and with Director Wilson's comments there that there's not a need to put a cap on the price. It'd be very hard to manage and just increase the uncertainty. It wouldn't give the certainty to the producers on their economics, how they would run. I guess I came in and envisioned how I would factor that into my economic analysis of a heavy development project.
Okay. Representative Gatto.
Yeah. What if we did something like this where there's an equivalency? A barrel of light oil has a certain value. A barrel of heavy oil, depending on how much it costs to get it out, depending on the value of it, depending on how much extra it costs to ship. And if you start deducting to make them equivalent, and maybe you reach $10 a barrel, and we incentivized it by $10 a barrel, would that be some way to deal with it?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I'm not quite sure I follow that.
Well, heavy oil is worth less. heavy oil is harder to get. So basically, when you get a barrel of heavy oil to market, and it's out of your hands and you're collecting money, you're going to collect a certain amount of money less than if you were selling a barrel of light, sweet crude. What is the difference? If we knew what the difference was, for the argument, $10, one selling for $70, the other one selling for $60, because of the equivalency, and maybe it's not $60, maybe it's $50 or $40 or something, and we just made up the difference, then as the price of oil dropped, we essentially would be essentially paying for all of it, and we'd simply be able to get the royalties share of it. We wouldn't let it bottom out below zero, but, and I guess the question is the equivalent value of a barrel of heavy when you take away this extra cost and the lower selling price.
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I think that would be extremely complicated and difficult to administer, and perhaps Robin Wilson can provide some thoughts on that. I can't see how that would be a very workable solution administratively. The price of oil, those changes widely, even within a given day, on the open market. And I think it would just be a very tough thing to administer.
Can I just comment first before?
Sure.
It doesn't matter what the price of oil is. What we're saying is the equivalent value is going to be $30 less than today's price, or $30 less than tomorrow's price, if it's tomorrow, or if it's next year. It's so many dollars a barrel less. So when you have equivalent, you don't have to do any calculations. You just say this oil has this value, and the state will make up the difference.
10% or 12% or 13%
less. Ms. Wilson?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I agree I believe it would be harder to administer, and I guess I have concerns about auditing that, and I may not have thought through your idea completely, but in addition to trying to settle on the prevailing value and all of it, now we're having to sort of individually fight about, the differential, what they could have gotten if it had been, lighter crude. And I don't know, perhaps I haven't thought it through, but it doesn't seem like it would be a really easily workable, certainly not enough that it would justify perhaps the advantage.
Seaton?
Yeah, thank you. And I think it was Mr. Spencer the other day that was here, and I asked what was the difference in cost to produce that barrel of heavy oil versus the regular oil. And at that time, he was going to get back to us because he didn't want to say off the top of his head. But I think that's what Representative Gatto is saying is, hey, if it costs $10 more to produce that barrel of oil, of heavy oil, that's the incentive that needs to make it equivalent to light oil. And, there's no calculations other than we decide at one time, okay, we're going to say that it's $10 a barrel or $11 a barrel or $8 a barrel, whatever's the reasonable amount, and then how many barrels they produce, it's times $8 a barrel or 9 or 10 or whatever that number is that we set, and this is the credit. So you're not having to worry about percentages and all this stuff. It's you're just calculating, okay, you produced 10,000 barrels of heavy oil, and we know the incentive to produce that oil is not some percentage of your cost. It's a percentage. It's $8 a barrel. And that's the credit that would be given on the air. I think that's where Representative Gatto is coming.
With the one addition of the value of the product. So you could say 8 more to produce it, and you get $3 less when you sell it. So that's 11. Every barrel you pull out of the ground, we pay $11. And then we sell it
or whatever we get.
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, you know, if the committee wanted to go that way and the committee knew about what number is the cost differential and that was in statute, that would be pretty easy to administer. Mm-hmm. But if we're going to, on a field-by-field basis, on a month-by-month basis, try to divvy up costs, assign them to either light or heavy, then I can see absolutely an auditing nightmare.
If we say that everything from West Sac, by definition, we've just determined that, or that's going to be in the bill here, everything in West Sac is heavy oil, and West Sac costs you $8 a barrel more. I mean, we're not going to fix that problem in the next 5 minutes here, but it's anyway, I'll talk to DNR about it.
That's a lot more money than 15%.
Well, we were just guessing at an argument
more
number.
And yeah. Yeah, you have something to say. We're a friendly group. Mr. Hurley, welcome back to the table.
Again, for the record, my name is Michael Hurley with ConocoPhillips. I mean, it's basically the kind of policy call when you want to try and incent development of a differential kind of crude. You can do it basically one of two ways. You can either incent by providing some kind of credit or uplift or something on the development cost, or alternatively, you can do it the other way and try and figure out that differential mm-hmm. for the particular crude itself, and you can make it so many dollars per barrel, so many cents per barrel, whatever you want on the actual product being produced from that field. You can do it either way. Both have their pros and cons. The different fields that we've got in Alaska that are heavy oil are going to have different kinds of challenges. I don't think you could find a single number that you could say for West Sac it's going to be so many dollars a barrel. UGNU is going to be a lot different challenge. Mm-hmm. A lot of the work we did in the early days looking at the UGNU, we were actually looking at trying to figure out a way to mine it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the cost differentials you'd get into for the different kinds of fields would be very difficult to do in that methodology. I think the sponsor originally thought this up and going with the other way of trying to provide an incentive on the development dollars, recognizing that you're going to get a lot more incentive on the UGNU because you're going to have to spend a lot more development dollars. So 15% of development dollars is going to be a lot bigger at UGNU than it would be, for example, at West Sac.
Yes, Representative Gatto.
But UGNU has a number that's stuck on the name UGNU of $8, and West Sac has a number that's nailed right into the side of the barrel, and it's called $7. Then whoever produces it in whatever quantities, it's a pretty simple calculation that says this oil gets
bounty.
This barrel has a bounty on it, and it's a $7 bounty. You get that just by turning it over. And now it's up to you to say, you know what, I like that bounty. I'm going to produce what I can at $8. I wonder if I can get 9 out of these guys. I'll talk to these guys on Resources Committee and see if I can squeeze 9 out of them. Well, that's what we're doing. But you don't have to calculate much. If it comes out of the ground and you put it in a wood stave barrel, we know what it's worth to us that we have to pay. Then we get the parts that we get back. We say that's a good deal for us, bad deal for us. But it's pretty simple.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I mean, that is true. Mm-hmm. That is a way to do it. Mm-hmm. It's an alternative way. Then the problem you've got is you've got to find experts to figure out what the right number is tagged onto what barrels. I mean, that's.
And we'll hire ConocoPhillips to determine that for us.
Have to send it down a
Representative Olson.
The wooden stave barrels.
There's a certain appeal to it, and that's the fact that we wouldn't be giving a credit until we actually had some product coming out of the ground.
Right. You're motivated.
Mr. Chairman, this is Jeff Spencer.
Go ahead, Mr. Spencer.
Just wanted to throw out, like, for example, UGNU, it's going to going to be many, many years before there is any commercial development of Ugnew, if it ever gets developed. The long time horizon, you guys have been talking about a 10-year sunset. By the time we could get anything going, the provision would be up, and so there is no incentive to the oil companies to develop the Ugnew if it was tied to this per-barrel thing. So I see that as something that would be very tough, unless you had no time horizon on the end of it. It could take us 10 years before we even produce our first barrel. And so we would not recover anything until many years beyond that under a per-barrel scenario. Whereas as far as the investment, if we can make the investment in the next 10 years, there would be some incentive to try to accelerate that development.
Okay. Representative Rookberg.
Mr. Chairman, I think the point is where it sounds deceptively simple to be able to do that. That would be the cost of each of these different formations, and how you assign that cost is going to be different. And it would be an ongoing auditing situation to try to determine what it was. I mean, it's just a heavy, labor-intensive type of thing that I think it would be very difficult to do. It's not as simple as it sounds. If you're trying to assign the actual cost delta between what a light crude equivalent would be and a heavy crude.
Well, we'd have a number that didn't sunset, and we'd say, you know, after you've pulled out the first 10 million barrels, the stuff that's left is even worse. So we come back here and we say, it was 8, we're going to make it 9 or 10.
I think that would be an excellent idea for a different piece of legislation. Excellent.
We're in the conceptual phase.
Excellent discussion. Well, I'm on to my last item on my list, and it's 3:30, and we spent 8 hours in this bill, and we haven't drafted a CS yet that we can use. So I'm hoping by 3:30 we can all walk out that door. Last item on my list of things.
Mr. Chairman, before you go on, Ken, I don't know whether we got to any definitive.
The rate that floats with the price.
I mean, to me, if we look at a three-year window and it's over $50 a barrel, that's the decision they're making. They're making decisions on that base, and it seems to me like we're just giving lots of money on the table. I mean, if the idea is to incentivize this in 3 years at $50 a barrel, isn't incentivizing them to go into projects, and we've got problems.
And I see it that if they're looking at investing over a 5-year time frame and having no hope of getting oil for six or seven, do you incorporate this into the math, or do you not incorporate into this math? And how would you know? So you're at $70 a barrel now, and you're right. We're throwing money away. There's no doubt about it. And then next year we're at 50, and the year after that we're down to 35 again. And all of a sudden, they didn't incorporate into the math. The project doesn't go forward. They did incorporate it into their math.
Well, the project definitely goes forward because they get the credit if it goes down to 35, if it goes down to 40.
When do you spend the money? I understand the tax rate doing that, because as the product comes up, you get a different rate. When you spend the money and how much you spend, are you going to wait? You're going, well, the price of oil is going to drop next year, we think, so we're not going to spend money this year. Hoping to get a higher credit as the price drops on one of your pivot points. Ms. Wilson, help me out. I'm not seeing, practically speaking, I understand leaving money on the table at $70 a barrel. You know, nobody wants to do that. But practically speaking, from either their perspective or your perspective, how would you possibly administer when you would have this series of expenditures for exploration or development?
Yes, and Mr. Chairman, that's exactly what I was trying to describe a few minutes ago. Just the timing issue. I can see a scenario where it can be $70 oil today, and then we plummet into a, much lower, or the reverse. And it just seems to me I could see claims, we didn't know it was going to be this good or this bad, and claims being amended. I don't know. I think it'd be problematic with a oil price trigger.
Representative Crawford.
I think we're losing sight of what we're, what we're after here. If we put this in with a price ceiling for the credit, you know, you're putting a guarantee in there that if it falls below $50 a barrel or 55, whatever it is that we decide, that they're going to get the credits. But they don't need the credits at over 55. So, I mean, that's the only planning that they need to know about is that area below 50 or 55 or whatever it is that we decide. And if it falls below, then, yeah, they'll get the credits. If it goes above, they've had plenty of incentive, the fact that oil is already way up there.
And I guess the idea that we're talking about a pre-calendar year average, I mean, it's not as if this is something that monthly fluctuates. I mean, we're talking about, you know, you said calendar year, go to a three-calendar year average. But if in the next 10 years we find that we're at $120 a barrel and we're giving 15% extra, I mean, if we're on an average price above $70, $80, $90 a barrel, and it's possible. It doesn't matter. If it is that average price, guess what? The credits don't apply, and they are making money hand over fist developing that. If it goes down, then they get the credits automatically. So it's not as if it's it fluctuates one.
Your idea would be they'd get the credits on all of the expenditures that they've had. Instead of 70, it's one thing to sit here and have the discussion, but let's say we put the pivot point at 50. When instead of fluctuating right now, we're going from 69 to 71. 3 weeks ago, when we all sat in this room on the PPT, we used our kind of our magic number. We all wanted to be at a certain place at $60 a barrel. It was going between 59 and 61. What are you going to do when your magic number is 50 and you get a 15% credit? Well, it drops down to your 10th, and all of a sudden, 15% credit, you get $40 million. And all of a sudden, you don't get it. And all of a sudden, you get it. And then you don't get it, and then you get it, and then you don't get it, day by day.
No, three-year average price.
So, three-year average every day that they make.
No,
they're going to make an expenditure today.
Three-year on a calendar year, and they'll know for the next calendar year where they are. Three-year calendar averages, and you know if you're in 3 years where your average price in three calendar average years is above $50 a barrel,
so for 12 months.
That's right.
For the next 12 months, and if the price went to $80 a barrel again, it's okay.
It's okay.
And they get the 15%. Representative Brokaw.
Mr. Chairman, a couple of points. Number one, if we set a cap on it, the cap will get gained. Because if I was running the field and the price went through the cap, I'd say shut down investment. Stop it. We'd still be producing, but any new investment, I'd say shut down. We'll wait for the price to go down before we start spending money. Yeah.
You're not going to do that at $50 a barrel.
Yeah, you are, because I've been here around long enough to know that the price goes up and down. It does.
But
so you game it.
But the thing is, it's an average. It's a year-long average.
You know what that'll do? That'll shut it down for 3 years in.
Losing control.
It'll shut it down for a longer period of time. Yeah, it will.
Shortly will be followed by my patients, Representative Seaton.
Representative
Seaton.
Okay.
Thank you. With a three-year average price on a calendar year, everybody's got the planning stages they need. There's no question that you're going to get it for the next year. It's calculated yearly. If it's above $50 a barrel, every drop of oil they're producing now, that heavy oil, is in the really profitable stage. If it's below that, in the three-year average price, guess what? We're automatically giving them the 15% credit. And so it seems to me that it's self-correcting. It's nothing you can game, because you're not going to be able to game your long average price. And so, anyway.
Thanks.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Roquefort.
Sorry about your deadline here. I appreciate that. But
we haven't gotten
to I would say this. The intention of this bill is to get investment in heavy oil. And, you know, frankly, from my position, I don't care if they're making $100 a barrel. If they're investing more into heavy oil and learning more from new technology and lifting more and more at a lower API, that's what this whole thing's all about. So if you that is the whole idea here. That's why it does have a sunset. That's why we can control it in that regard. And I think that there's sometimes when you have to say, we want to put a smile on these guys' face to start pumping downhole money into UGNU and stuff like that. we just heard testimony that even we started right now with this 50 is probably not enough because they don't know enough about how to get Agnew out of the ground. That's the 50. They've got 20 billion barrels up there just sitting there. That's what the whole point of this is. So I think you can game a three-year average, and we'd have to put language on it and said that this is, you know, the average only starts 3 years from now. I mean, or you'd be looking retrospectively at the three-year prior average. You know, so then where do you set it? Yeah, I don't know. You know, that's a Ouija board, dart board game right now because we don't have a history to look at.
I've got 3 year
very,
average.
Very last one. Okay.
I mean, it's really easy. I mean, they've got 3 year average prices of West
on
Texas
what?
Intermediate or
they do on and, that, and then the
through, cross the, through the chair, Representative Seaton was speaking.
And so it's not as if this is not
committee meeting.
Knowable number. I think that these are whether we take West whether we take West Texas Intermediate or we take ANS West Coast or whatever number we've got, those are all known numbers and they're all calculated and average prices is right there before us. So we just have to make a decision.
Okay. And that decision will be debated again whenever we get this out. The last issue that I had of the what I considered the major issues on the bill was gas. Gas is in the title, and when the engineers testified, that generally speaking, there's not a lot of gas associated with heavy oil. Generally speaking, that's one of the reasons it is heavy oil. That as a technical aspect, that was so I was satisfied with that. It's not, I can't see getting gamed on having gas infrastructure being built in a heavy oil field. If they find some gas, it's not going to be the amount of gas, the free gas that's at Prudhoe and Kuparuk or Point Thompson type thing. So I was satisfied with that. Seaton, I know you have some questions about that.
I think that, you know, as long as we're putting the 5,500-foot limit in there and identifying the fields, I don't have a problem. Okay. We just wanted to make sure that we didn't go out and before we had the we had it covering anywhere in the state, basically, which could have been a real problem. But since we're doing the fields, I don't have a problem anymore.
Okay. With that, I will work with you. I will work with the sponsor. Whoever wants to be involved, as we will try to draft this over the next
weekend.
Well, I'll be here, but I don't know what problem's going to be. We need you and Mr. Mintz to make sure this thing all flows. I mean, let's be perfectly honest here.
My only, I need to be at Senate Finance.
I'll bet you
get.
Have plans on two other pieces of legislation that might be moving through this
that,
box.
That's the only one.
Mr. Chairman, on this.
Representative Roper.
If I could ask Ms. Wilson, given the fact that we're just kind of trying to true up, if you will, to use a term of art, kind of, on subsection F, that whole issue. From the tenor of the conversation today, you have to true this up to 488 in terms of its application. Wouldn't that be correct, Mr. Chairman? Try to have that language that was consistent with that so that gets clarified there.
On subsection F?
Yeah.
On page 3?
Right. And anywhere else there, you have to make sure the credits in the above sections there.
We'll need to trip the language. PPT and we'll just need to go through everything.
Right. I think that would be real helpful because that's one major drafting area that we need to look at. I think we had consensus on that, basically.
Yeah, I think we had consensus on most everything. We still have to work on commissioner versus legislature to see how that goes, and then the rate floating with the price, which will just have another interesting debate. I'll get with you all the things that we discussed. I think we went through basically the entire bill of all the major issues. So we'll just have to need some help from you and Mr. Mintz on the drafting of the new CS. Yes.
Was there consensus on the exploration? I guess would be my only question.
The consensus I got from the committee was exploration no.
No?
No.
Okay.
It's not going to be an exploration tax credit bill. That's the consensus that I thought.
Because okay. That would affect how we true it up
okay.
with
PPC. Okay.
Yeah, I can live with that if we can move around on the capital.
Okay, I don't think there's any more business before the committee. Thank you very much, Mr. Mintz, Mr. Hurley, and everybody that's online.
Thank you, sir.